Hello and welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast, the official podcast of the Maryland Association of Counties. My name is Kevin Canale, the policy associate here at MACO, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, MACO's executive director, Michael Sanderson.
Hey, Kevin.
And Michael, the circus is in full swing here in Annapolis. Committee hearings are going well into the evening. Lots of testimony. Annapolis is really jumping.
Yeah, it's the first few weeks that we've been having these conversations, it's been warm up. There have been a lot of briefings. A lot of times you bring in the staff to talk about a big issue you're going to be dealing with in your committee. And that's part of what January is about. Shift gears in early February. And the bills are really on their way.
They are really on the way. We certainly shift gears here into February. So today we are going to discuss a few things. First, a twist in highway user revenues. We'll get into that discussion, talk about some new ideas being floated. Next, we'll talk about the sick leave bill. We have an update there as well. Mm-hmm. Despite a veto last year from the governor and a last-ditch attempt by the Senate to delay implementation, it looks like that law will go into effect on Sunday.
Right.
After that, we'll get into one of MACO's legislative initiatives, which had a hearing this week. That is Senate Bill 285, the Commission to Advance Next Generation 911 in Maryland. We'll look at the influx of bills introduced this session, as Michael mentioned, talk about some numbers and how we have evolved over time, how this compares to bills introduced in previous sessions. And finally, we will discuss Senator Edward Casemeyer's announcement that he will not seek re-election next year and what that may mean for the Senate Budget and Taxation Committee and Senate as a whole. Mm-hmm. So, Michael, let's first talk about highway user revenues, and you have an update here for us.
So, we do. We're in the phase where legislators are dropping in the bills that they want their names on to introduce. And as we've talked before, highway user revenues is the phrase for the share of state transportation revenues, the tax you pay on gas, the tax you pay when you buy a car. For decades and decades, 30% of that got distributed back to local governments, shared among Baltimore City, the 23 counties, and all the municipalities, basically so we can maintain our roads. We do about 5 out of every 6 road miles is maintained by local government. All the roads that don't have numbers on them are maintained locally. So that's the share we've used to count it on, and we've talked about how this got cut back during the Great Recession. We've been limping along since then. It's been a high priority to get things back on track. Interesting twist, we were talking about this a bit last week and saying, is there the potential for the municipal governments and the county governments and Baltimore City to all get on the same song sheet?
Right, because last week we said there are a number of highway user bills introduced so far this year, and that's great, right, because that means that more people are paying attention to this issue. Local folks are going home and telling their delegates and senators that this is important, constituents. And we've seen a number of these bills, but now, as we discussed, there's an opportunity for everybody to get on the same page.
Right. So as of a week ago, we were thinking maybe this might turn into a set of amendments. And this happens a lot in Annapolis. A bill gets introduced, but it needs to be refined or changed in one way or another. So we were thinking a week ago that maybe the plan would be we'd just pick one of these bills and everybody in, let's all, get on the sleigh and turn it into a toboggan, put amendments onto the bill that brought everybody together in some sort of compromise way. What we sort of got, inspiration from House sponsor on MACO's own bill, Delegate Pam Beidle. Mm-hmm. She's an Anne Arundel County delegate. She's a subcommittee chair in the committee that looks at these issues in the House. And she said, I know the Senate bill's already gone in, but I've got the House bill right here. Why don't we just mark up this bill and introduce it as the deal?
So instead of having to make a bunch of changes to a bill, make this as simple as possible. Make this, this is it. This is the full restoration. This is going to be the bill, and not have to look at all these different bills and have legislators pick and choose and try and figure out what this one does and what this one does. Now we have a bill that, ideally right. Everyone here is on the same page.
Yeah, so that's the goal, and I think it's a really good idea. So House Bill 1569 was introduced today. We actually can't see the text of the bill. This giant flood of bills has made things administratively a little bit difficult, but in a day's time or so, we'll be able to see the text of the bill. But what it should have is a fairly rapid restoration of the municipal funding. Their nut is a lot smaller than the amount you need to come up with to get the counties and Baltimore City back on track. So it gets the municipalities whole in the space of 2 years, mm-hmm. gets the rest of us whole in the space of 8 years. We've got sign-off from MACO. We brought this to our legislative committee, talked it through, and agreed, okay, this makes sense. The Department of Transportation has said an 8-year phase-in for the bigger chunk of this is going to avoid disruption on projects they've already got in the pipeline through the State Transportation Trust Fund. You know, we don't want to upend that.
Sure, that's important.
Right. So we'll do it. We would do an 8-year phase-in. The municipalities do a 2-year, but we get everybody back where they were supposed to be. And as a practical matter, what we'd love to do is say, okay, delegates, here it is. You know, thumbs up or thumbs down. Let's go.
Yeah, so again, just the single bill, here it is all at once, take the one vote and don't have to mark up bills that have already been introduced. It seems like this is certainly a big deal, and this is certainly what we've heard from a lot of delegates and senators, frankly, is why can't there just be one bill?
Right, and so another thing that's nice to see here is the sponsor line on Delegate Beidle's bill. It's not just her, mm-hmm. it's not just Dems. The second sponsor listed is Delegate Anderton. He's a former mayor, a former president of the Maryland Municipal League. He's one of the champions of the municipal restoration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, him being on board as a co-sponsor on this bill, I think this is just pointing the arrows in the right direction. This is an issue so important to local governments and so important to the people who have been fighting on this issue for years. Let's just reduce the potential for sideshows.
Yeah, let's get it done and hashtag find a way. I think we've been discussing here internally, and we hope the General Assembly will find a way. This is certainly making it as easy as possible for them to do so.
Yeah.
So we'll keep you updated on that issue as it progresses. Next, Michael, let's get into sick leave. So this has been a process. So last year, the General Assembly passed, as we all know, the sick leave law. House Bill 1 of last year, the governor vetoed the bill.
Right.
This year, the House and Senate came back. First priority was override that veto. They did so. The chairman of the Finance Committee, Senator Mac Middleton, who really brought the bill in last year on the Senate side, he has been a champion of this issue. He's worked on it for many years.
Right.
He knew that, look, maybe we should compromise here. A lot of people have a lot of questions. There's people very concerned in the business community about this bill being implemented right away, and that's because, of course, you know, the veto was overridden. So normally you'd have a lot more time.
Right.
But now it was 30 days from when they overrode the veto.
Right.
So Senator Middleton introduced a bill to delay the implementation. The Senate took up that bill. They amended the bill. Originally, the delay was going to be for 60 days. They then amended the bill to not to go into effect until July 1st. The Senate passed that bill out just yesterday. And then the big question was, is the House going to consider the bill today? Because that's what everything rides on. The House did not take the bill up today. So that means that the law is set to go into effect on Sunday, February 11th. And, you know, this process has just been really fascinating.
Yeah, it's quirky timing arising from the strange veto process. And part of this is this bill didn't get to the governor's desk last session, back in April of 2017, until the last several days of the session. Governor has, I think it's 10-day period of time to make a decision on vetoing a bill, and that time, the clock didn't run out before the legislature went home. They dropped the gavel, they, you know, dropped their confetti and so forth on Monday night. That's over, and then the governor had time to decide what to do. There were some other bills that kind of were moved along quickly, suspecting that the governor might veto them. This one, with the veto in April, then you end up, you know, twiddling thumbs until the legislature is next in session.
Right.
And that brought it out till January. So it's a peculiar circumstance that you have a bill like that. Ordinarily, you pass a bill in the month of March or April, and you give it a July 1 effective date, or October 1 is the most common. In this case, 30-day clock started January 10th or 11th, whatever.
Right away.
Yeah. So you know, the 30-day clock expires this Sunday on February 11th, and I mean, I guess there's there's a theoretical way that you could let this go into effect, and then the legislature could pass something to effectively suspend it or suspend enforcement. It's not inconceivable that there's a reaction legislation this year, but I think the window the window has really passed. The Senate took it up, sort of got everybody on board to resist, you know, taking amendments to lots of other new issues. We talked about this previously.
Yeah.
But I think the sense is this bill would get to the House and you'd have a laundry list of amendments and alternatives being offered. You might not be able to end that debate.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this, as you said, that the concern in the House, and by the way, the House leadership was always cool to this idea of, you know, we're gonna delay the implementation. And like Michael said, I think the concern was, we're going to open up old wounds here. We've already passed this bill. We don't want to have this circus-like atmosphere on the House floor, and trying to end that debate would be very difficult. Right. So they didn't consider it today. We did support the implementation. We went and testified in the Senate to delay the implementation of this bill. There has been a lot of people very concerned, counties and businesses across the state, about, you know, saying we're not ready yet. We don't have the policies in place. We've talked about, you know, as counties, we're a little bit different because to make personnel changes, we have to have public hearings. We need to, you know, make time for public input. So 30 days really is not conducive for us to make these sweeping changes. Right. Unfortunately for us and for the business community, it doesn't look like we'll see that delay. On Sunday, the bill will go into effect and officially become law. Yeah. I think what's important for our people and the business community to remember is that the most important thing to do is make sure that you're documenting, beginning on Sunday, the accrual of time for your employees. I don't think, you know, it's very likely that anybody from Dollar is going to be, you know, crisscrossing the state, you know, finding people and locking people up, whatever they're going to do right away. I think there'll be time, but it's important that you document that leave and have records starting on Sunday.
Right. And I mean, you can see how this process is going to work practically for our county governments, our members of MACO. We're going to have jurisdictions that, in the main, county governments already give benefits to their full-time employees. We don't really have all that many part-time or you know, the other sort of
seasonal.
Yeah. So we don't. That's not really the centerpiece of the county government workforce. So we're going to have a lot of counties we're going to have to make specific adjustments because we have leave of one sort, but it may not fit the letter of this bill.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there will be jurisdictions who it may take until the month of March before they have the new policy formally adopted, and you'll just retroactively tally the numbers back to February 11th, and I can't imagine you're going to be in deep trouble as long as you know, acted in good faith.
Yeah, if you're acting in good faith, you should be fine.
Yeah.
So, again, Sunday, the bill will go into effect and become law, and we'll keep you updated if, as Michael said, there is always a way to go in and change that, but this was the window, it seems, and it passed. We're going to go ahead and take a break. After the break, we'll get into Next Generation 911, this influx of bills that we've seen, and some big changes coming to the Senate. All that and more after the break. Welcome back to the Conduit Street Podcast. Kevin Canale here with Michael Sanderson. Michael, one of our initiative bills, the Commission to Advance Next Generation 911, had a hearing this week in the Senate and the Finance Committee. And if I can say so, I think it went really, really well.
Well, that's one of the reasons we go through a process to pick top initiatives each year. We have, you know, a committee of elected officials who sort of chart the course and pick top things that we should be focusing on. And we spend time in September, October, November, December, getting our ducks in a row and getting the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And the purpose for that is this is a big deal to us. We need to convey that clearly. And one of the ways you do that is when you have a bill hearing on a bill that's your top priority, it's the A team.
Absolutely.
And they were sure out at that Senate hearing.
They were. We had a caravan of people coming in for that hearing. We had people representing, you know, everything from Montgomery County to Cecil County to Dorchester County. So counties, large and small, urban and rural, we're all there on the same page saying that this is important. We need to advance this issue forward.
Right. And these are the directors of the call centers, the public safety answering points in each jurisdiction. And, I mean, the challenge in a Dorchester County is going to be different than the challenge in Montgomery County. But for that group to be speaking with one voice and saying, we need all the stakeholders together to be working on this issue. It's going to be an effort that's going to take a couple of years, but we need to sort out the financial side. We need to sort out the management side. We need to be thinking about procurement. We need to be thinking about oversight. There's a long list of things like this. I know it's not thrilling, you know, to be putting together a task force or a commission, that sort of thing, but I think every stakeholder on this issue is really persuaded that it's complicated, it's multi-jurisdictional, you want to do this right, and you want to do it statewide. So this is the right venue to do it.
I agree 100%. I mean, this effort was started in 2012, by some delegates then and now senators, actually. And so we know that this has been evolving, and now we're here in 2018, and we want to advance this issue forward. As you said, there are many questions on how to do this. I think this commission really is going to set the framework for how we can best, you know, move forward with the planning and then the eventual implementation. I think that is a really good selling point that, here you go, it's very complicated. Let's get the right people into the room and let them figure out the best way to do this so that we can all move forward and all boats rise at the same time across the state.
Right. And this is one of those issues where modern technology just sort of forces your hand. I mean, we're trying to provide public services, and 911 is one of those things that's a centerpiece of what local government is about. We've gotten Americans comfortable with the idea of dialing those three digits to get whatever you need. You don't have to, you know, I mean, when I grew up, I'm dating myself a little bit, but I had a sticker on the phone that said, this is the number for the police department, this is a different number for the fire department, and things like
poison
that.
Poison control.
Right, yeah. So you get past all that, and you have a single number in every state that everyone knows. That's a big advance.
It's remarkable.
But now you're at the point where the nature of the stuff coming to the 911 center is really different and way more complicated, and there's an appetite for even more. So in addition to, you know, calls coming from cell phones or wireless phones and trying to find their exact location, that's a big part of what we're trying to do. But you're going to have people who are going to want to, I have a photograph, I have a video, I'd rather send a text, I can't talk right now, I'm in a dangerous spot. And if you've got a phone that enables you to do those things, we owe it to those citizens to be able to take that information and help them.
Absolutely. Like Michael said, that's the goal here. And, you know, unfortunately, our 911 infrastructure was built during the landline era. And of course, now we are in the cell phone era. Very few calls are made from landlines anymore. So updating that equipment to, as Michael said, make it much more user-friendly, improve location accuracy, and then, of course, the ability to text and videos, all multimedia to 911, is crucial. So,
and the idea of, you know, if the call center can get video that explains the nature of the problem. Here's a photograph, or here's some video that shows the person who's, you know, who's lurking outside the home, or that sort of thing. The person who's causing a problem, mm-hmm. that's creating the emergency. That's going to have our first responders better prepared when they show up on site. They'll know they're looking for this person who's you know, fits a certain description. That's helpful.
Certainly, hopefully, saves them time to be able to get sort of a real time landscape of what the situation is before they get there. I mean, that's critical.
So this was probably the easier of our two hearings on this issue. We've done our homework. We've got a sponsor in the Senate, Senator Kagan. We have a sponsor in the House, Delegate Jackson, who has a comparable bill in the House of Delegates. The Senate has already shown some interest in this subject. Last year, they took a larger bill that had a lot of components, and they whittled it down to several things that we still were interested in. They passed it, and like the whole Finance Committee amended on as co-sponsors of the bill after they got a sense of what was, you know, what the amendments were leaving in the bill. It was, you know, anyone want to be on this bill? And every hand is in the air.
Yeah, they've heard this. We also briefed that committee during the interim. They know this issue, but I think what you're getting to here is the show, and really the our focus needs to be in the House, because they really haven't had a chance to hear about this issue, at least not as much as they have in the Senate.
Right. And so we'll be working with Delegate Jackson, and I mean, talk about a resume for this issue, right?
Right.
Delegate Michael Jackson, he's a former sheriff. He works in Prince George's County on Homeland Security. And so, you know, in one of our large jurisdictions, he's a guy who's living this stuff day to day. So
he speaks the language.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, that's kind of this citizen legislator concept. Mm-hmm. So he's got a full-time gig doing this sort of thing. I don't think there could be anybody better in the House of Delegates to be carrying the water and saying this should be a priority.
Certainly agree. So we will have a hearing in the House on February 21st. We'll keep you updated on the progress of this bill, but very good hearing this week in the Senate. And I think that is great for this initiative.
Yep.
All right, Michael, let's talk now about the bills, right? Today we saw 420 bills introduced in one day. Have you ever seen a day where there are more, where there have been more bills introduced?
I think this has to be a record. This has to be the biggest day ever. And like we've been hearing for the last couple of weeks, lots of legislators walking around pacing, saying, I'm still waiting for seven more bills to from bill drafting, and I'm trying to make it in for the deadline. I know one of the things that happens with this big rush of bills to introduce is there are delegates who they've already gotten a handshake or an agreement that someone will co-sponsor the bill, and that might be somebody important. Maybe it's a committee chair leadership person, or you know, someone they've been trying to work on in, or with their district mate or something like that. But suddenly you don't even get the copy of the bill until the day it has to be dropped in. There was a big scramble around yesterday,
and the hopper was overflowing.
It's just physical mass of delegates running around with these blue bags. It's a funny looking thing. It's a bundle of papers with this blue piece of paper and a paper clip and six or eight different things clipped to it. And people have like inch and a half thick stacks running around, signatures and everything like that. And then what you end up with is this morning, not one, but two synopses, each of them like 70 or 80 pages long, over 400 bills introduced in one day. I don't know if that's an absolute record, but that's like the most overwhelming morning I've ever seen.
It's overwhelming, yeah, a lot of bills. And I really think DLS deserves a lot of credit. I mean, the influx of bills, along with the flu going around Annapolis,
right.
And I think, you know, they were impacted as well. It's not just legislators and other folks. These guys and these gals have been working nonstop and on weekends to get these bills drafted. And I mean, It's quite a task, and they've done a fantastic job to get these bills out.
Yeah, that's a department that's going through its own transition with staff level leadership, and that's not a trivial matter either. And at the same time, you know, they're in the midst of crunching numbers on all these tax issues, other things that we've been talking about. The budget analyses are already rolling ahead, and these are big 30, 40, 50 page documents with recommendations and all this analysis. So there's an awful lot of paper being generated in this town in February.
They are slammed. Yeah. So just to give you an idea, so as of today, we have seen 670 House bills and 1,037 Senate bills. By the way, there are many more to come. This is not the end. The filing deadline has passed, but we expect a lot more bills to be coming.
So that's 1,670 House bills. Yeah. So we're up. At 2,300 bills. Or I mean, it's big numbers, and they'll keep coming from here. The Senate deadline was several days ago. The House introduction deadline has just passed. That's why we saw this big lump in the snake. But on Monday, there will be a big bundle more of House bills, most of which were probably introduced on time. They just ran out of time to physically print the bills. So so as a practical matter, this is the big rush, but there will still be introductions each day of a few more bills. A lot of things will get reassigned to that rules committee, where they have to go through some procedural hurdles before getting assigned to a standing committee. All that stuff is, you know, encouraged to keep things going, but you got to think about this timeline. You know, we did sort of the session ABCs mm-hmm. several weeks ago with looking at the calendar and terminology and so forth, but we're all working backward from the crossover date. So March 19th is the official date where House bills that you want to pass should be out of the House. Senate bills they want to pass should be out of the Senate. It's only about 5 weeks away. And a lot of these bills are just landing, you know, just landing on the list for each of their standing committees. And the committees will start scheduling them for hearings. But those hearings are going to go out into March 5th and 10th and 12th. A lot of these are going to be right up against that crossover deadline.
Yeah, we've already seen bills being scheduled into March. Yeah. So, yeah, it's really crunch time for these committees to get the bills scheduled. And they deserve credit as well, because they're also having to figure out ways to get all these bills heard before crossover.
Right.
So let's say, 1,670 House bills, 1,037 Senate bills.
Right.
In 96, just to give some reference here, there were 806 Senate bills and 1,463 House bills. That was for the entire session. So we've already blown past that.
Yeah.
And last year we had 1,200 Senate bills and 1,661 House bills. So we already have more House bills this year than we did last year, and we are rapidly approaching last year's number of Senate bills.
Yeah.
So that gives to give people an idea of what's going on down here. When we say the circus is in full swing, we mean it.
No fooling. And you know, we're, as we record on Friday, one of our next stops is going to be to go to our big board and look at all the testimony we've got scheduled as bills that have a county effect, where Mako's taking a position or we've got something pending for the week ahead. And I guarantee you there's going to be pieces of purple paper all over our big board. I'm sure there's 40 things out there for us to be tending to next week.
At least. And you know, we have to figure out, you know, we're supposed to be in six committees at this time, and how that all happens. It's quite a process, but we always make sure we get it done. Yep. We don't miss bills. All right, so Michael, let's get into an announcement this week from Senator Casemeyer. He is, of course, the chair of the Budget and Taxation Committee. He is someone who is very, very highly regarded and well respected in the Senate. He has announced that he will not be seeking re-election. This is a big blow, I think, for the Senate. For the Budget and Taxation Committee, and this comes on the heels of Senators Madaleno, Mano, Curry, and DeGrange also not coming back to the Budget and Taxation Committee. And so that's five senators that we know of.
Right.
Have you ever seen a situation where a Senate committee is going to lose this many members and has the potential for this big of a facelift going into next year?
It certainly is possible that it's happened in numbers, mm-hmm. but I think just the depth of the shadows we're going to lose here.
Experience is unbelievable.
Right. Yeah. This B&T, as all the insiders call it, is going to feel like a really, really different place next term. And that, I don't mean that in any kind of slight against the current members who will likely be returning. But Senator Casemeyer, we start with him. That was kind of a surprise announcement. Mm-hmm. This is the month of February. Filing deadline for running for state office is just a couple of weeks away. He's made a decision that he's done and not going to come back. But you add to him, I mean, Senator Madaleno, the sitting vice chair, he's in the midst. He's filed and he's pursuing the Democratic nomination for governor. So he's already made it clear he's not coming back to his Senate seat. Senator Curry was for many years the chair of Budget and Tax before Senator Casemeyer. So Senator Curry has also, you know, made it known he's not coming back. So those are big hitters. It was several weeks ago, Ed DeGrange from Anne Arundel County. He's a subcommittee chair and the Capital Budget Committee chair.
Yeah.
And if you play this game, capital budget is a really big deal. That's not just another beat. So
and of course, Senator Mano's running for Congress.
Right. So Senator Mano's seeking a congressional seat. He's announced he's not coming back. And who knows what the voters might have in store for us anyhow. So there's always the potential for something to happen either in a primary or in the general election anyhow. But even if it's just those five members of a 13-member committee turnover, you're talking about it's the murderer's row.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, I think you could see a lot of people were just shocked at the announcement from Senator Casemeyer. He got a standing ovation on the floor this morning. Just so well respected. He's known for being fair. He has a very moderate temperament. And just he's been around for a long time, and he has gained and earned the respect of his colleagues. And it's certainly noticeable just the shock that was, going through the entire General Assembly.
And from MACO's perspective, I mean, especially I've been doing county government stuff for an awfully long time, and every single one of the senators on this list is someone that we have worked with, who's reached out to us. We've made compromises, and we've supported their bills. And I've probably testified in favor of and in opposition to multiple bills for each of these senators. I mean, that's how the system's supposed to work. But I mean, all of them, really good people to work with, and they'll be missed. It's part of the process that folks decide they've had enough, or they're going to pursue something else. And in Maryland, frequently, if you want to pursue a different station than you currently have, you got to walk away from what you have. That's built into our Constitution, but it does mean you'll have this massive loss of institutional memory in that committee.
Yeah, and again, as Michael said, it's a big blow, but and not meant to as a slight to the committee moving forward, but just that institutional knowledge, it's important.
And it's a big deal committee too. I mean, my background is on fiscal issues, and in the House of Delegates, you have the Appropriations Committee that does the budget and the spending side, but the Ways and Means Committee does the revenue side, taxes and funding formulas and other things like that. So B&T basically has both of those functions. I mean, not in their entirety, but the spending and the revenue side are both consolidated in one committee. I don't think it's a stretch to say structurally that's the most powerful committee in Annapolis. So it's a big deal. We at MACO spend an awful lot of time in the Budget and Taxation Committee, and we will next term. And there'll be new leaders there, and we'll be extending relationships with all of them too.
Of course we will, and that is important too. That this is part of the process when you're in this game. So we wish nothing but the best for all of them, and we look forward to working with new members of that committee and the General Assembly as a whole. That'll do it for this week's episode. Michael and I and the rest of the MACO staff are going to go swim in these purple papers that are going to be strewn around our office and try and work out testimony for next week. We do hope that you enjoy the podcast. Give us a like and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We will be back next week. Until then, signing off, Michael and Kevin. Talk to you later.